Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Eve Ensler. She's creator of the Vagina Monologues and V-Day, the global movement to end violence against women. And she's the editor of a new book, A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer. On Sunday, this Sunday, June 24th, there will be a reading from the book, a fundraiser for V-Day at the St. Francis Auditorium at the Museum of Fine Arts at 6:30 in the evening. Welcome, Eve Ensler.
Hi, happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, some of your listeners may not know your work. How did you begin the process that led to V-Day?
Oh, it's a long process. It really began with the Vagina Monologues and performing that play and traveling with that play. And so many women would line up when I was performing it to tell me their stories. At the beginning, I thought, okay, these are going to be wonderful stories about women who love their bodies, you know, great sex lives, and et cetera, et cetera. And what invariably happened was women were lining up to tell me how they'd been raped or beaten or incested or gang raped or mutilated. And it became overwhelming, and I was really going to stop doing the play because I felt immoral not doing something about it. So in 1997, we got a group of women together in New York, and we just said, how could we use the play to end violence against women, to stop it? And we came up with this idea called V-Day, which was initially a day, an idea, a catalyst, a movement to end violence against women. And we did a production of the Vagina Monologues with wonderful actors and sold it out. And we thought, well, that will be that. And instead, that evening was so powerful that it launched this energy, this catalyst, this movement that has, in the last 10 years, spread like wildfire around the world, and so much so that it's in 119 countries now. We've raised $49 million. We've, you know, I think had really huge impact on ending violence against women and getting people to think about it, talk about it, and really focus on the centrality of the issue and how profoundly it impacts every aspect of our lives.
You talk about how people respond when they see the Vagina Monologues and they come up to you and tell you these things about themselves, abuse or violence in their own lives. Often it's the first time they've admitted it to anybody, and it's tremendously emotional. What's it like for you to witness this over and over and over again after years all over the world and to be the recipient of these overwhelming emotions?
Well, you know, I think you go through various stages. I still can't believe that it's the year 2007, and we are still battling violence against women to the degree that we're battling it around the world. I can't believe women haven't come into their power. I can't believe the world isn't safe for women. I can't believe we're, you know, I just got back from the Congo, and actually I was in Haiti earlier, you know, this summer, where women are living below second-class citizens, you know, and where violence is so ordinary everywhere in the world. I mean, one out of three women will be raped or beaten in their lifetime, and that's a UN statistic. So we know it's probably an underestimation because they're very careful about their statistics, you know. And I think as much progress as we've made, and we have certainly made progress, we have still, people are still treating this like a, quote, issue, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not an issue. Women are over 50% of the population. We're talking about the desecration of the majority of people on the planet. And it still gets relegated to an issue, like something we'll get to after all the other issues, as opposed to life itself that we're talking about.
You know, I was watching the V-Day video yesterday. It's called Until the Violence Stops. And it made me think about that dynamic that I go through. I think a lot of people go through it, between wanting and not wanting to know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you want to be informed, you want to do something. On the other hand, you just don't want to feel the pain and powerlessness. How does that work for you, and how does that work with your art and your activism?
Well, I'm at a different place, I think, because I spend so much time and so much of my life listening to stories and sitting with women, and I do want to know. I you know, as painful as it is, I want to help somehow tell the stories and communicate what's going on so we break this terrible silence and we break the shame and humiliation that's connected with it, and we break the taboos, because as long as we keep ourselves uninformed and as long as we keep that denial up, women continue to be raped and slaughtered and tortured, and horrible things are done to them. So I feel like the thing I think we need to communicate to people is that knowledge does not depress you. Knowing things does not undo you. It is the resistance of knowing things. It's the refusal to know things, ironically, that undoes us. Do you know? It's all the energy you have to spend not knowing is the thing that begins to rob you of your central life energy. And I certainly, you know, I came back from the Congo a few weeks ago, and I was utterly shattered. It was, without a doubt, the worst atrocities I've ever heard. But at the same time, I knew it was there in my consciousness. I've read about the Congo. I knew there was something I wasn't telling myself or finding out, which was occupying some part of my brain and some part of my energy. And knowing it has allowed me to act and do something in support of the women of Congo, which has freed up a whole excess of energy.
What were you doing there? What did you see and hear from the women in the Congo?
Well, you know, last year in V-Day, we had a spotlight which was on women in conflict zones. So we were looking at women all over the world who, where violence escalates and is intensified, and particularly rape during wars. And we've seen this beginning, you know, early on in human civilization, but certainly in recent wars. We saw it in Bosnia, we've seen it in Rwanda, we've seen it in Cambodia, we've seen it throughout the globe. And so I made a point last year. I was invited to Haiti to spend time visiting grassroots groups who are working to stop rape, which is incredibly out of control in Haiti right now. The coup and all the militarization of Haiti really kind of legitimized rape as something that just happens now in the country. And so we were there working with the women's groups and the women's ministry, and I'm very happy to say that we're going to be opening the first safe house in Haiti in cooperation with the women's minister and the government and local groups on the ground. And then I went to Congo at the bequest of a doctor, Denis Mukwege, who is this extraordinary man doing really some of the most profound work I've ever witnessed on the planet, at a hospital in Bukavu where women are literally showing up with their vaginas and parts ripped apart, mutilated, desecrated from rape and all kinds of atrocities being done to them. And he has just been there for years now, sewing up women and healing women as fast as the militias can rip them apart. So we went, I had interviewed him in New York at the bequest of the UN in December, and we went there to support him and learn more. And the trip has truly revolutionized me. I feel very, very, very devoted to supporting him and supporting the women there, and we're going to launch a huge campaign, and we're going to do all kinds of work because these atrocities simply cannot go on.
When you're in places like Haiti and the Congo, are you identifying and cultivating leaders in places like that, you know, to work with these safe houses?
I'm sorry, are we doing what?
Are you identifying leaders? Are you cultivating leadership among the women there, among the people there?
Oh, absolutely. And the leaders have, in many cases, already identified themselves. They are running these local groups, you know. They're running all, I mean, in Haiti, for example, in Cape Haitian, we met wonderful women who have been leading organizations, you know, really with nothing, and still they are creating profound change and keeping an enormous amount of spirit and hope alive. They did a production of the Vagina Monologues in Cape Haitian in a Catholic girls' school, and 500 people came, you know, and there was a huge march in the streets, and the same thing in Port-au-Prince, and in Congo, the same situation. We met many local women's leaders who are actually cultivating other local women's leaders. And I think a big part of the work of V-Day for the next 10 years is going to be moving women who have suffered terrible violence and atrocities into leadership positions. You know, turning that around, turning poison into medicine. We've learned, you know, we call them vagina warriors in V-Day world, but women who have been through enormous suffering and who have not gotten arms and have not gotten machetes, but who have grieved it and experienced it, then devote their lives to stopping it happening to other people, other women, and they are without a doubt the strongest and fiercest leaders.
Did you actually do the, was there a performance of the Vagina Monologues in the Congo?
Well, we did a reading of it with the female staff at the Panzi Hospital, and it was fantastic. It was truly fantastic. And so there's all kinds of talk of moving that forward in the future.
One of the things that struck me in your in the video, Until the Violence Stops, was that some men who get involved in this movement, wonderful men, catch flack from other men. What does that dynamic look like?
Well, you know, I think it depends on where. I look at someone like Dr. Mukwege, who to me is one of the fiercest vagina warriors I've ever met. And in that hospital, there was a group of fantastic men who are totally working 12 to 14 hours a day to support, protect, empower, and honor and respect women. So he's changing. You know, there's the militias outside that hospital, but within the hospital, just one man having a vision of women that's a different vision and giving his life to support and honor them totally has impacted a whole community of men. And I think what's really going to be required in the next 10 years is for men who are good men, men who really understand what violence is doing to women, women, men who are brave to really come forward and be bold about standing up against violence against women, so that other men can then go, okay, I'm going to go there too. I'm going to join that and not be afraid.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. The rape, torture, mutilation, murder of women, not to mention psychological violence, ridicule, all those things, they're so common that it's easy to forget that we don't always really even understand it. I mean, everyone says it's about power, but why do men who do things like this, who are already bigger and stronger than we are, feel the need to exercise power, and especially this violent power that breaks our spirits?
Look, there are many, many, many theories on this, and believe me, I have spent my life thinking about it. Most recently, I think it has a lot to do with powerlessness. I think that men begin as tender, vulnerable beings who are full of enormous compassion. And I think they're born into patriarchy and they're born into this hyper-masculine world, which from a very early age begins to convince them that they need to toughen up and become a man and straighten up and not have grief and not have doubt and not have tenderness and not have vulnerability. And I think often men, boys, witness their mothers, their sisters, their aunts, their grandmothers be violated. And I think at a young age feel incredibly powerless and incredibly hopeless and incredibly sad. And they don't know what to do with that. And either that turns into a Dr. Mukwege who, you know, after witnessing a sick mother and feeling really devoted to her, he then devoted his life to other women, or it turns into a militiaman who is now going to punish everyone in his path for making him feel that way. And I don't know why, you know, men choose different directions. I think it has to do with the level of humiliation and the level of shame. I think that shame and humiliation takes all kinds of forms. I think it comes in the form of, you know, masculinity shaming, but I think it comes in racist shaming. I think it comes in poverty shaming. I think it comes in homophobic. I mean, I think there's so many forms and ways that men are shamed and eviscerated. And once they hit a certain level of powerlessness and self-hatred within their own being, because there's no resources to appropriately deal with those feelings, it gets directed outward. And they strike out at what I think is most representative of life itself and what is most beautiful and what is most powerful and what is most, you know, what is the deepest reminder of the part of themselves they have lost, which is women.
And what is also not going to be able to fight back.
That's right. That's right.
There was in the new book, A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer, there's a piece by a woman who was the victim of an attempted gang rape. And she, when this thing was happening, she realized that if she let it happen, it would destroy her. And she fought and fought and clawed and punched and elbowed, and they finally left her alone. But the thing that struck me about that piece was that at the end, one of the men who was involved in this gang who tried to gang rape her picked her up by the elbow and gave her this look, and she realized that it was fear.
Yeah.
And that's another dimension of this stuff that I think is worth talking about. Inside of all these other feelings, there's fear inside of the person who's doing the oppressing, doing the
Absolutely.
Torturing.
I think there's fear, and I think there's a way in which if you allow and if you have no way to process very difficult feelings, and it builds in you and builds in you and builds in you, eventually it's going to explode. And then you put that together with male bonding and groups, and you put that together with war and propaganda, and you put that together with ethnic hatred. You know, you've got a pretty disastrous boil of things. And I think most men who engage in violence are as terrified of what they're doing. I came from a father who was very, very brutal. And I can remember the times when he would beat me or throw me against walls or whip me. I knew he was terrified of what he was doing to me. I knew that part of him didn't know what he was doing and was out of control and was really scared of his own behavior, and yet he couldn't stop it.
What is it that, for a man who's doing that, if you want to get to these people, you want to get to violent fathers, you want to get to militia people, is there anything that you've seen that allows them to go deeper, to release, to start doing things a different way, to start healing?
Well, I think we have to bring boys up, first of all, to know that they have a right to their feelings and a space to have their feelings, and that they're not less of a man or less of people if they feel vulnerable or lost or that they want to cry. I mean, I've talked to so many young men who tell me that they were brought up not to be crybabies, that their heart was cut off at such a young age by fathers who wanted strong men and didn't want soft boys. And I mean, I think it really begins early on. And if it doesn't start early on, it's much harder to correct later. But then I think it's also working with people who are violent to find out what is at the core of that violence, rather than just kind of erasing people and determining them evil. You know, good people, evil people, saints and evildoers. Mm-hmm. I think looking at what makes people violent and investigating it and probing it and going deeply into the grief that's underlying it is crucial if we're really going to transform a culture of violence. And America, by the way, is one of the most violent cultures I have ever been in.
It's interesting that you say that, because something I wanted to ask you was, if you've been places where women really are respected, where there's a culture of respecting women, cultures that are less violent, you've been all over the world. I was wondering.
I have yet to find a culture that respects women.
Really?
I'm still looking. I'm searching the globe. I mean, really, we're at its core that women are honored and held sacred. Hard to find.
Wow.
I think there are aspects, I suppose, of certain cultures. But, you know, the thing about the world which we constantly are forgetting is how interwoven and interconnected everything is. I mean, I think what was going on with women in Afghanistan and then the latter outcome in 9/11 hopefully showed us all that if you allow women to be undermined and oppressed and muted and tortured and shut down in one part of the world, it will ultimately impact all of us. But I think the fact that we give license and we allow situations of horror and atrocities to occur to women in certain parts of the world actually sends a signal to everyone in the world that it's permissible, that it's okay to treat women like that. And I think that's why it's crucial that we stand up anywhere in the world where women are being seriously violated in a massive way, where, you know, there is no punity, where there is no support from state structures in those countries that have failed.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. Can you explain why it is that people, both women and men, but particularly women in the context that we're talking about, feel guilt and shame about acts that are perpetrated against them, things that they didn't do?
Yeah, I think it's a very compelling and interesting dynamic. I think I can speak from my own experience, and then I can speak on a more, you know, broad level. I think if you are perpetrated against by someone you love, it's very hard, particularly if that's a parent or somebody you're dependent on, it's very hard to tell yourself that that person meant it and is a bad person and wanted to do you in, because that is your primary, you know, source of sustenance and life. And so to tell yourself that your father, for example, wanted to rape you and meant to do you harm would be so annihilating on an existential level that you blame yourself, you know, because that way you can keep that particular person alive in your consciousness as loving you, which you need. I think also it is so hard to believe that people really mean to hurt you, that someone actually comes into your room with an agenda to murder you or to rape you or to violate you, that it's just hard for human beings, I think, to believe that people mean that. And I think to believe that so deeply changes our character, our kind of constitutional makeup, our existential framework as human beings, that it's easier to blame ourselves in order to hold a frame of reference for humanity that sustains us.
And so we blame ourselves because on some level that feels better than seeing the world as an existentially cynical, horrible place.
Exactly. Because then how do you live in the world? If having just come back from the Congo and seeing these atrocious, barbaric acts towards women, how do you walk around thinking, if human beings are capable of this and they mean this, what does that mean about us all? What is that telling us? And I think it's very hard to go there, particularly if those people are people you know, particularly in situations like Bosnia or Rwanda or where neighbors turned over people that they were best friends with and you know, Hutus and Tutsis were incredibly close for years and people were being turned over within a matter of hours. The same thing happened in Bosnia. The same thing happened in Germany. When you see that, it's very hard to keep your faith intact. So what you say is, God, I must have done something wrong to deserve this. I must have brought this on myself. I must have done something to because it's so much easier to do that.
And you saw that in humanity. Saw that in the Congo too?
It's interesting in the Congo because I think it's a different situation. Although everybody in the Congo is now raping. I mean, it seems like every militia is raping. And as somebody said there, it's a country sport. Initially, these series of rapes began with the Interahamwe, the FDLR, which was the Rwanda genocidists, who were allowed in to the Congo in refugee camps initially and were allowed in over the border, who then began raping and destroying the Congolese people the way they had done to the Rwandans and the Tutsis. And I think a lot of people really feel that that never happened in the Congo before then, or certainly women said that to me. Since the FDLR has been there, they have radically influenced, I think, a lot of the militias, so that the Congolese army in some ways is doing as much, if not more, raping than the Interahamwe. And so I think one of the things I saw in both Haiti and in the Congo is that war often legitimizes rape, and the militarization of a country actually makes rape something that becomes something everybody can do. And so, for example, in Haiti and Rwanda and a lot of war-torn countries, rape really escalates after peace, ironically. That's the worst time of rape because somehow there's been license given to it.
How does that play out in the United States, which is more militarized both in terms of military spending and police presence than it was when I was a little kid?
Well, I think we look at the statistics of violence in this country. I mean, you know, guns and rape and murder and everything that's going on here. I think one of the things I feel very strongly is that you cannot have a government that has legitimized preemptive strikes, for example, which is hurting somebody before they're even threatening you, and has legitimized occupying and dominating and invading countries, and not think that it won't have an impact on people on a national and domestic level. Of course it impacts people. If you see your government launching attacks and just going into places and dropping bombs and eviscerating neighborhoods and napalming children, and of course it's going to influence you as a boy to believe that you have those rights and that domain over women and over territory in your own localized reality. And I think, you know, I think the militarization of this country and the empire, you know, development and our whole incredible military bullying zeal that has really escalated insanely throughout this administration has completely impacted boys and how they treat women and how they see themselves and macho. And I mean, just look at young entertainment, look at hip hop, look at girls, how they have deeply objectify themselves and believe that the way to get attention is by showing their bodies, which they're barely inhabiting anymore. I mean, it's had an enormous impact.
Does that show up in terms of rape statistics as well? I mean, has there been an increase?
You know, the thing with rape statistics, it's always really confusing, in my opinion. One of the things we've seen in V-Day over the last years is that it rises and falls, but when people feel safer, they come out and they talk about being raped. So I think many more women are probably talking about being raped today and being out about it than they ever were before. So it's hard to know rising and falling,
right?
You know, like, which we do know in families where men are coming back from war, it's an incredible increase in domestic battery in the family.
That's
documented across the, you know, and, you know, I think the most dangerous situations are often families where men have come back and have PTSD and have been traumatized themselves and then begin to take it out on their wives and children.
Let's talk about the new book, A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer. It's an anthology of writings by well-known and lesser-known people, men and women. It's fiction, nonfiction, drama. How did you choose these four categories, and what's the common thread?
Well, what I really wanted to do was to create a... We were doing a festival last year in New York. It was a two-week fantastic festival called Until the Violence Stops, where we essentially occupied all the boroughs of New York and with the desire to make it the first safe place on earth for women and girls. And I'm very happy to say that the festival is now being replicated in Kentucky and Ohio, with lots of requests coming in for more festivals next year. But the desire was to create a book where I would ask all my favorite writers to really put their minds and hearts and poetic and deepest creative selves to the subject of violence against women and to see what they would come up with. And so, you know, basically we wrote to all of my favorite writers and people I admire and people who I think are great thinkers and just asked them. And, you know, I was expecting maybe 10 or 12 people to write back, and we were inundated with people who wanted to write, which was very, it was very hopeful-making.
Yeah.
And I just think there's just the diversity and the different attacks and approaches on the subject and the different... You know, the different filters that it's come through with different writers. It's just utterly fascinating and very moving.
It also shows that there's a role for humor in all of this. I'm
mm-hmm.
actually one of the readers in the Sunday event, and the piece that I'm reading is both a little rough, but it's also funny.
Yes, yes. No, I think. Well, we know that humor is the way that people can hear things without, you know, shutting down and disappearing. And I think, obviously, art is the way that people can hear things, because art has the ability to hold ambiguity and to hold question and to hold all those things that often in politics we aren't holding. You know, we just get into polarized opposites or positions or, you know, and I think art opens those doors to ask really vital questions that need to be asked right now.
So you've raised nearly $50 million in the time you've been doing this work, which is incredible. How do you determine where it goes?
Well, one of the things that I love about V-Day, and I feel very strongly about, you know, V-Day is a movement. We're not a charity. We're not even really a foundation. We're a movement. And why I make that distinction is I think sometimes we get very caught in capitalist philanthropy, which I'm very suspicious of to some degree. What I'm interested in is people empowering themselves and raising their own money and moving themselves forward without hierarchy and without an empire standing behind them calling the shots. And the way V-Day works is that people come through attraction rather than promotion, and they desire to do the play, and there's a whole team of people all around the world that support them in doing that. And they put on the play, they produce the play, they, you know, do all kinds of activities surrounding the play, and whatever money they make, they keep. So it's really, the whole process is the process of empowerment, and the only thing we ask is that they give 10% to the World to to whatever the spotlight is that year. So, for example, this year, 10% of all the money that got raised went to Congo and Haiti and Afghanistan and Iraq and Lebanon and countries that are, are facing really, really bad times in war. Direct awards go to countries where they can't put on the play without risking enormous danger, or where they just don't have an infrastructure to do that. And what I love about it is just about all that money goes to women who already have projects designed, who know what they're doing, and they just need the resources to do it. We don't ever tell people what we think they should do. We don't ever create programs for people. They know what they want, and we service that. So when we were in Haiti, our job was to ask questions about what people needed, and then when they told us, we found resources to help them do what they're doing.
I love the example of Agnes Pareo, who is an African genital mutilation activist, anti-mutilation activist, and she was walking from town to town educating people and was asked by you, what do you need? She said, a Jeep.
That's right.
And
so we got
simple.
Her a Jeep. And then as she had that Jeep, she reached 4,500 girls. And afterwards we said, well, what else could we give you? And she said, give me money and I'll build a house. So we gave her money. And 3.5 years ago, she built the first FIDE safe house to stop female genital mutilation in Africa and is wildly successful. And we just raised, a local group in New York just raised her another chunk of money, and she's opening the second house. And she went from being a scorned woman because she was fighting taboos to deputy mayor. She just won UN Woman of the Year. And I will tell you, Agnes Pariah always knew what she needed to do in Kenya. She had a vision. She was a woman who was cut herself. She knew what she needed to do. All she needed was the resources to do it. And I think, to me, it's called self-empowerment philanthropy. It's very different than top-down philanthropy or control you behind the scenes philanthropy. It's very different.
The courage that these young women exhibit when they go to these safe houses is just incredible, because they are willing to and often separate themselves from their family, and their families won't even talk to them anymore because they are refusing to get their genitals chopped up.
Well, I think what's really exciting about Kenya particularly, because there are rules and laws in Kenya prohibiting FGM, when girls now come to the house, and many come on their own, and they know how to find it because Agnes has so well publicized it, they stay until the point where they're out of danger and they won't be cut. But I think in all cases, Agnes has done such educational work with the families themselves that all the girls have been accepted back into their
family. Is that right?
Yeah. And it has to do with her educating their parents and educating their brothers and educating so that the whole community is involved in the transformation and the ending of FGM. And I think, a big part of what's happening in that program is education. Girls are getting educated. Girls are becoming empowered. She actually has two buildings at the site, and one of them is a school. And the new house she's building is next door to a school, because she is making that linkage between when girls don't get cut, they get to go to school. When girls get cut, it stops their education. So I'm very excited to see not only how many girls are getting educated, but how their families are changing. Because when the family changes, the society changes.
It sounds like, all of these places where you've been able to do things that have an effect, you also do a lot of follow-up. It's not just like you give them a Jeep or a house or whatever and go away. You're continually involved.
Well, what I feel about VIDE is, because we're a movement, I can't think of, maybe there's been a couple places early on that there was money given to where it was a one-off thing, but we're in this for the long haul. We're in this until the violence ends. That's what our logo is. So with someone like Agnes, or with someone like Ghanar Muhammad in Iraq, or with someone like Zoya in Afghanistan, or with the women in Haiti, or with the women in Congo, we're here for the long haul. This is not just a one-time deal. We're here until the women are free. We're here until female genital mutilation ends. We're here until they stop raping and eviscerating women in the Congo. We're here until they stop disappearing and raping women in Juarez, Mexico. And I think it's really important that we know this is a struggle, that it doesn't end tomorrow, and that we're all signing up for the long haul. Because I think what happens in America is we go from one thing to the other, and then we get done with mm-hmm. places, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And rather than going, you know, there's a beautiful expression in Nicaragua, which is that struggle is the highest form of song.
Wow. And
I think we don't have practice in our muscles in this country of struggle. We don't know how to struggle. Things have to be quick and easy, and then we lose our attention, and we lose our patience, and we're done. And if you really want to change lives, you have to hang in there for a long time with people. You have to be, you know, you have to be in partnership with people. You have to be in a movement with people that keeps going. I mean, I look at our program in the Middle East, which started 3 years ago, run by an extraordinary leader named Tabak Osman. And it started in Cairo. It is now in 9 countries. It is spreading like crazy through the Middle East. She's having enormous impact. But, you know, we're in our 4th year there. And I think by the 7th year, radical things will be happening, you know?
We're talking to Eve Ensler. It's one waits for this 100th monkey thing to happen somehow, or not waits, but works to see that it can happen, where something flips and suddenly a war that was going to be fought isn't fought. Have you seen, on a massive scale, obviously we're not close to being there yet. Have you seen that on a small scale, a local scale?
Well, this is what I feel about V-Day. You know, we're about to celebrate our 10th anniversary, and by the way, we're celebrating it in New Orleans for the women of New Orleans next year on April 12, 2008 at the Arena Superdome with the greatest stars in the world, with all kinds of women leaders from all over the world, and we hope everyone will come. I think V-Day is just beginning. I mean, I think I think in 10 years, we're going to hit that place you're talking about. Someplace in the next 10 years, it's mm-hmm. going to flip. We're talking about 1,150 places on the planet doing V-Day every year. We're talking about thousands and thousands of activists. You know, I was in the Congo, and a woman flew in from Bunia who wanted to meet me because she had done the play in Tanzania. And I met a woman the other day at the UN who had done it in Uganda. And, you know, it people in Antarctica, it's everywhere. And I think if we keep going at the intensity we're going at, the level we're going, eventually there are going to be so many V women and men across the planet that it's going to flip.
Did you say Antarctica?
I did. There's an amazing picture that was sent to us at the beginning of V-Day season this year, women and men in Antarctica doing V-Day.
Is there a violence against women problem in Antarctica?
Well, I guess there must be. And what was really fascinating is apparently the first time they did it, a lot of men came and stood up to talk about how much violence they had witnessed in their own lives
yeah.
with their mothers and even themselves. And now I guess there's a vibrant movement in Antarctica.
Amazing. I thought it was just a few scientists down there and a lot of penguins.
Well, there's also a base. And I don't know how many people are there. I think it's a few hundred.
Good heavens. How do you keep yourself grounded? You're on the road all the time.
You're
you see the darkest.
I'm grounded.
What?
I don't know that I'm grounded. I feel...
Well, maybe sane is the word.
Okay, sane. I am living the life of a nomad at this point. And I think for a while it was very difficult because I think there was still part of me that was clinging to the idea there was a place I was supposed to be like home. And that was making me crazy. And once I realized that where I was supposed to be was where I was, everything became fine. So I think I, whatever reason and, you know, whatever this incredible thing is called the Vagina Monologues or V-Day, I feel so profoundly grateful that it's taken my life and that I'm in service to it. And I really, truly believe that if we can figure out how to end violence against women and how to empower women, that everything will come into rightful balance on this planet. I know it. I don't just believe it. I know it. And so there is a way when I think of Dr. Mukwege in Congo, and I think of Zoya in Afghanistan, and I think of Agnes in Kenya, and I, you know, I think of Yanar in Baghdad. I get up every day and I feel I am in this communion and in this solidarity, and I'm in this work with people across the planet who are shifting this paradigm of violence and occupation and domination into a whole other paradigms. And I know it's possible if enough of us get engaged in that work in a bold, outrageous way.
One thing I've noticed is that people in the United States, I don't know if it's like this everywhere else, but they love to talk about gender differences. And I think sometimes it's annoying because you get these sort of silly joke emails constantly about gender differences. But I feel like what they're trying to do is sort out all these questions about sexuality and power and identity. And I wanted to ask you, having seen so many people and places and cultures, so many more than I have and that most of us have, what do you think are the strengths of each gender? And what do you think it would take for us to really get along in stability and peace?
No, I don't know if it breaks down with gender necessarily or it breaks down with feminine, masculine development inside each person. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certainly many women in power who are, in my opinion, not necessarily manifesting themselves as women. Do you know? That they're much more male-identified and much more, their behavior is much more male and much more allied with a kind of patriarchal model. I think, you know, what women carry in us, and I'm not saying men don't carry this as well. That's why I'm not sure it always breaks down along male-female. I think what the feminine principle is, or what it's certainly trying to manifest to be, is an awareness of community, has to do with consciousness of the future, has to do with how we live in cooperation as opposed to domination, how we walk with each other and resolve conflict without destroying each other. And I think that energy is not at its maximum at this point, which is why there's such imbalance. I'm really interested in women who come to power as women. That really, really interests me.
Who are some examples of that?
Well, Agnes Pirillo is an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she came to power in her community, making sure what happened to her didn't happen to other people. And she's committed with her life. She's not committed for power. She's not committed for economic gain. She's committed because she knows if girls are rescued and aren't cut and are educated, that her world and the world around her will get better. And I think really where I've seen this most manifest is on a grassroots level. Those women on the grassroots level who are providing leadership that comes out of an understanding and experience of transformation, to me, are the great leaders on the planet. I have a lot of time, I just have huge questions about people running for political office, particularly in this country, because so often it just seems to me they have lost their authenticity, or if they ever had it, they aren't coming from a place where their need to change the world and improve the world is at the core intention of what they're doing, but rather their need for power or their need to, you know, move themselves forward. And I think until we have leaders who come from a different basis of intention, we're not going to see real change. We're just going to keep the old structures in place.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, that flip you were talking about that you hope and expect to happen within the next 10 years if world leaders, political leaders, start to have the attitude the grassroots activists have.
Well, you look at someone like Wangari Maathai coming to power, who was a grassroots activist, and you can see the shift in the way she operates in power. And I think that it will start to happen in the next 10 years that we see grassroots women coming to power. I do. I really do.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. Do you want to tell us about your latest play, The Treatment?
Sure. I did a play that was done this fall, and it just got done again in San Diego about a month ago, called The Treatment, which my wonderful son, Dylan McDermott, starred in, and with a woman named Portia. And it was really, obviously, living in this country, I don't see how you cannot be disturbed by a government which is essentially licensed torture and without any kind of legal repercussions. And I was very, very disturbed by what happened at Abu Ghraib and very disturbed by what happened in Guantanamo. And it's still happening in all kinds of, you know, illegal prisons and offshore sites that we don't even, you know, have control over yet. And so I wanted to do and look at how torture and committing torture actually destroys the torturer. and how being put in a position in an army, in the military, where you are being directed to do immoral acts, how that ends up destroying your own soul. And to really look at what we're doing to the people that that are being forced to carry out illegal, immoral actions.
Will that be performed in other places?
Yes. The DPS service, the Dramatic Play Service, is just about to release it, and it will be available. The rights will be available in the next month or so.
Well, Eve Ensler, I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us on KSFR.
I love talking to Mary Charlotte, and I'm thrilled you're going to be in the reading.
I know. It's a wonderful, I'm honored to be in the reading. I mean, you're going to be there, Ali McGraw, Jane Fonda, Val Kilmer, Santa Fe's own Jonathan Richards, and Cynthia Ruffin. Many people are going to be taking part in
Valerie
this.
Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson.
Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson.
I know. It's going to be wonderful. Wonderful.
And that's on Sunday night, the 24th of June. At the St. Francis Auditorium. And for people who want tickets, it's almost sold out. So give a call, 988-1234, to get your tickets. And I think a few of the expensive gala tickets, which get you good seating and a copy of the book and a reception with the cast afterwards, are still available.
And get many, many good deeds done in V-Day world.
Exactly. Eve Ensler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eve Ensler is the creator of the Vagina Monologues and V-Day, the global movement to end violence against women, and she's the editor of a new book called A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown.